From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, casting a nervous eye on the aging Sioux locks, especially the Pollock for those giant ships. Is it past time to build a new lock?
There's much of a feeling that if something happened, particularly to the Pollock, without anything to get those large ships through, it could be catastrophic.
She's hailed as the founder of Detroit's historic preservation movement, Beulah Croxford.
Everyone I talked to who knew her in her life said she was a tiger. She was a force to be reckoned with.
College football is back. John U. Bacon knows what Michigan fans hope to see from Coach Jim Harbaugh's team.
60 minutes of honest football. Offense and defense, blocking and tackling. The game has changed dramatically over the years, but blocking and tackling have not.
Those stories plus Hamtramck's Labor Day blast. Today on Stateside. We may be several years past the Great Recession, but the pain and job losses from those years are still being felt. And that's especially true among auto workers. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, the impact of long-term unemployment. But first, when it comes to keeping American industry up and running, it's pretty hard to overstate the importance of the Sioux locks. Those big ships carrying iron ore from northern Michigan and Minnesota on Lake Superior must pass through the Sioux locks to get to the steel mills that are on the lower lakes. So when there's a problem at these aging locks, you can bet business and shipping interests sound the alarm bells. Detroit Free Press Capitol Hill reporter Todd Spangler is with us now. And Todd, this has been a worrisome year at the Sioux locks, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the MacArthur lock, which is one of only two shipping locks at the Sioux, shut down for 20 days earlier this summer. It expected to be closed for only 10. During 20, everything had to go through the Pollock, which is the larger of the two, and it has a lot of pressure on it already.
And that Pollock is vital because?
Well, the Pollock, which is about almost 50 years old now, is the only lock up there at the Sioux that can actually handle the 1,000-foot lake carriers that travel through it. The MacArthur lock, the other one which is usable, can handle some of the smaller craft, but the Poe is the only one that can handle the largest ones, and they actually account for about 70% of the tonnage that moves through the lakes.
And what kind of downtime have we been seeing? Can you track it so you could map it where it's increasing?
Yeah, the Sioux locks still remain among the most reliable in terms of how many vessels, a percentage of vessels get stopped, you know, because there's a problem at one of the locks. But in terms of the number of hours or even days that vessels do get slowed down because of problems, it's been growing a lot in recent years. And that percentage of vessels that are getting stopped has gone from about 20% or so on average, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, to over 40% last year.
So as you explained to us in your story, the business and shipping interests are certainly watching closely. And I want you to give us a better understanding of the economic importance of the Sioux locks and its role in America's manufacturing supply chain, because you write if those two locks are shut down for any length of time, there could be catastrophic effects on the U.S. economy.
Absolutely. And there's a report floating out there that was done by the Department of Homeland Security. It hasn't been made public, but it essentially says a six-month closure of the Sioux locks could effectively plunge part of the nation into a recession, maybe the entire nation. There's a 30-day shutdown of the locks would have an economic impact of about $160 million in terms of economic loss. And the reason is that so much of America's iron ore, which fuels steelmaking along the Great Lakes, passes on these big lake vessels through the Sioux locks and onto the refineries and steel mills on the lower lakes. No, there's much of a feeling that if something happened, particularly to the Pollock, without anything to get those large ships through, it could be catastrophic.
And you note if recent history is any indication, it's likely to get worse before it gets better. Why? What are we in for?
Well, the Poe is approaching 50 years old, which is somewhat old. It has been pretty reliable up till now. The problem is that there's very little money in Congress that's actually to be put forward to build a second lock that would be the size of the Poe lock. And that's what people really want to have happen, is have a second large, supersized lock, if you will, up there, so that if something happened to the one, they'd be able to get ships through on the other one. The problem is that the supporters of that have been trying to get money for that since 1986. They got authorization from Congress to do a second lock in 1986, but since then the money's been slow, if ever, to come. And frankly, with the way congressional funding is going now, as well as many competing projects around the country, it's just unlikely to happen in the near future.
It kind of makes you scratch your head if it's so vital to the economy and Congress authorized construction of this new supersized lock almost 30 years ago. Why are we having this conversation in 2015?
Well, we have it all the time. I mean, the way Congress and this divided Congress has been working for really more than a decade now is that it's very difficult to line up continuing streams of funding for large projects. And we see this over and over again. If you want to, you could even look at the new international trade crossing, the Gordie Howe Bridge, as an example of where Canada and the state of Michigan went their own route to try to find how they were going to fund a new international bridge. This is another example of where Congress will not commit itself to continuing funding for certain kinds of projects. The Army Corps of Engineers has largely looked around and seen that, you know, there are other projects out there that they think need to be funded first. It's not to say that this won't happen. It's just to say that if it's going to happen, it's going to take a while.
And what should we watch for, though, in the future when it comes to allocating resources for the Sioux Locks?
The next real step here is that the Army Corps is talking about doing a new study that would look at the cost-benefit ratio of building another lock up there at the Sioux. They looked at that some years ago and decided that it wouldn't have the cost benefit that they thought it was going to have. Mm-hmm. There are some things now that suggest that study was dead wrong. I mean, that you can't move the shipments by rail. You can't move them by truck. There's just not the capacity to do that. That they will take into account in a new study, and that, if it's done here the next year or two, could move this up the priority list.
Detroit Free Press Capitol Hill reporter Todd Spangler. Always great talking with you, Todd. Thank you.
Thank you.
College football begins this week. The University of Michigan will kick off the Harbaugh era at Utah tomorrow night. And number 5, Michigan State, plays Western Michigan in Kalamazoo Friday night. Michigan Radio Sports commentator John U. Bacon is here. John, VegasInsider.com has Michigan State at 20-1 odds to win the college football title. That puts the Spartans at 7th.
I was going to say, that is not bad.
Yeah.
It sounds like a long shot, but if you're 7th, that's not bad at all.
Well, and Michigan has odds of 90-1 behind 20 teams when you consider last year, the Annus Horribilis. Did that surprise you, having them with just 20? Let's throw some Latin in here.
Nice drop on the Latin there. The Jesuits have done you well,
there
I
you
see.
Go.
Well done. Look, they were 5-7 last year. They earned every loss, and they could have lost some more. So It was just not a very good team. They were, frankly, not well coached. And as far as what Michigan has right now, look, right now we are all guessing. We don't even know who the quarterback is as of today. I'm sure we'll know by tomorrow. But even if we do know that it's Jake Rudick, and I think it almost certainly will be, he has not played a down in a Michigan uniform in front of this offensive line. Mm-hmm. So there are far more questions than answers. All we really know for sure is Jim Harbaugh has not failed wherever he's gone. So over time, he's probably going to turn it around. But it may not be this season.
We know that Jim Harbaugh had them in the submarine for those 3 weeks. We don't know anything. He kind of emerged briefly and went back in the submarine.
That's
again.
Right.
What are you looking for from a Harbaugh team?
Man, 60 minutes of honest football. Offense and defense, blocking and tackling. The game has changed dramatically over the years, but blocking and tackling have not. And Michigan was not very good at tackling under Rich Rodriguez, and they weren't very good at blocking under Brady Hoke for a variety of reasons, some their fault, some not. Mm-hmm. But what Michigan fans want to see, in my opinion, is 60 minutes of honest football, you know, start to finish. Jim Harbaugh almost certainly is going to give you that.
What about Utah? That's a tough opponent.
It's a very tough opponent. They're also playing in their stadium, which, by the way, gets quite loud. And this is the biggest game probably ever played in their stadium, even though Michigan's 5-7. But, man, Fox Sports is going to be there. It's the biggest game of the season so far, by far.
Season's just starting.
It is, but it will be. Those ratings you watch are going to be skyrocketing. And, hey, at 7:15 Michigan time, I'm on there for 90 seconds. Don't sneeze. Don't go to the bathroom. That's my little...
Your moment in the national.
My minute and a half of fame, I guess. But even that game is a great unknown. Mm. And one advantage Michigan does have is Michigan's got a ton of tape over Utah. They know the head coach. They know their players. They know what they're going to do. What do you do with Michigan? You know, look at Stanford? I don't know.
Big question mark.
The Niners? That's not going to help you. Yeah. So, and Jake Rudick playing at Iowa. They've got about 15 different teams they've got to break down, basically, to figure out what Michigan's going to do. They do have the element of surprise on their side.
Interesting. Over to Friday's game, Michigan State against Western Michigan. And these two last met in the 2013 season opener. And that was Broncos coach P.J. Fleck's first year. MSU did pull out a win, 26-13. But it was a closer game than a lot of people expected. And then we know Fleck won MAC Coach of the Year last season after leading Western Michigan to an 8-5 record. So what do you think Friday night's going to bring?
Michigan State, for them, it's a potential stub-your-toe game. because Michigan State is a highly ranked team and should be. As we've talked about before, in the last 2 years, only one team has been top five nationally, and it's not Ohio State, not Alabama, not Florida State. It is, in fact, Michigan State. You can win bar bets on that one, Sandy, I guarantee you. But that means don't look ahead of this game. Coach Fleck, by the way, his name keeps on coming up. He's one of the rising national stars. Next time a big-time program needs a coach, he will be going somewhere relatively soon. So do not look past the Broncos.
Interesting. What should Mark D'Antonio be doing to get his Spartans ready for the Broncos, not just in terms of play, but in terms of head?
Well, as Bo often said, the upset is in the mind of the favorite. In other words, they can't beat you without your permission. If your attitude is sharp and you're ready to go, the underdog really can't beat you. D'Antonio is extremely good at this. He's a tough guy. He's hard-nosed. The Spartans have won 11 games in 4 out of the last 5 seasons. That is what coaching looks like. And these are mostly 2- and 3-star players when Michigan's got the 4- and 5-star players, and they're getting their butts kicked by the Spartans. So I'm not too worried about Coach D'Antonio.
What about Coach Fleck? What's he doing for his team to get them ready to face the Spartans?
He's got a great advantage. One, it's at Waldo Field. It's at their stadium, of course. 2, they're not looking ahead of the Spartans. That's their biggest game of the year. And you pull off that upset, that'll be played at your banquet backwards and forwards 5 times. So this is an easy chance for him to get everybody jacked up and jacked up for 7 months. I'm sure he's been barking about this game since 2015 started. That psychologically is a great advantage.
Let's just put you on the spot. Final thought. As you look ahead to the end of the season between Michigan and Michigan State, who's going to have the better record?
Michigan State. Almost no question. I would go Michigan State 10-2. I would go Michigan 8-4. And I'd go Ohio State either 11-1 or 12-0, probably 11-1, only because it is so hard to repeat undefeated.
I'm writing that down, and we're going to check that at the end of the year. Final question. We got it. We were kicking this around. We know the Michigan team switched to Nike. That was a big marketing deal. Anyone getting wind of Harbaugh signing on to rep a khaki pants company?
Or a milk company.
Well, big start of the season coming this week, and always good to talk football with you, John Eubacon. Thanks so much.
Sandy, thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This weekend brings the 36th annual Hamtramck Labor Day Festival with its food, parade, music, carnival, and a whole lot more. It's all a testament to a tough city that refused to be driven to its knees by hard times, a city that's made even stronger by its diversity. We have the mayor of Hamtramck with us today, Karen Majewski. Very good to have you with us here, Karen.
Thank you.
And we say hi to August Gitchleg, who is the city clerk of Hamtramck.
Thanks for having us here.
Mayor, take us back to 1980 when this festival was created. What was going on economically in Hamtramck?
Hamtramck had just gotten news that the Dodge Main plant was closing, and that was an incredibly devastating blow to the city. Basically, the city grew up and was formed around the Dodge Main plant. That was what brought tens of thousands of people to Hamtramck in the early 20th century. To close that, the lifeblood of the city, was an incredibly devastating blow. Although it had been coming for several years and people had expected it to come, it was still devastating economically and psychologically and socially to the city. And so the festival was formed as a way to kind of cheer people up, to say, you know, we're down, but we're not out. And it continues to this day with that same philosophy.
Well, then talk about how the festival has grown, August, and since that time. It's been 36 years. It's through the best and worst of times, right?
Absolutely. And we've seen different economic good and bad times come and go, as all the urban communities in Michigan have, really. I got involved with the festival probably in 2001, long before I was city clerk. We did lose the festival once when we came under emergency management, and then we brought it back stronger than ever. And we've focused much more on local artists and local vendors. And then all these other festivals sort of came up at the same time. We now have to compete with your Arts, Beats, and Eats in Royal Oak, which is a huge budget. And we're just still a small town festival in an urban setting. I mean, we only have 2.1 square miles, but we're packing 30,000 some people in that 2.1 square miles. And the festival is very reflective of the entire community.
What do you think, Mayor, that this festival says about Hamtramck?
What I really love about this festival, besides just that it's a good time, is that it's homegrown. You know, we don't have corporate sponsorships. We don't have a big budget. We just have people in the community who want to see this festival continue, who want to throw a party for the whole state. And somehow they manage, your neighbors and mine, manage to put this thing together. And that is so impressive to me. And it's so indicative to me of what Hamtramck is, of the kind of community it is, where people take responsibility for their community. They feel invested, emotionally invested, and they want to see it thrive. And that's really impressive to me.
Talk a little about this festival and how it mirrors the diversity that's in Hamtramck. Because I think old-timers might think Hamtramck equals Polish.
Right.
Not so.
Not so. As a city clerk, I can put it this way. I have translators in my precincts that speak Polish, Bosnian, Albanian, Bengali, and Arabic for our Yemeni community. Mm-hmm. That's a challenge no other clerk in the state has. I guarantee you that. We actually print election materials in Bengali. So it is very diverse, but that doesn't mean that the traditional Polish has gone. We still have Polish Market right downtown. We have Kowalski Sausage. We have Schrodek's Meats. There's still people coming in from the suburbs and from the Midtown area doing their shopping in Hamtramck.
There's still a heavy Polish presence in the city. And our parade that we hold on Labor Day is the Polish Day Parade. So Monday is officially Polish Day.
How do you think, Mayor Majewski, that the diversity in Hamtramck has made it stronger?
People, no matter what ethnic group they come from, people are very proud of Hamtramck's ethnicity. Whatever they may complain about their neighbors, you know, this guy or that guy, they're parking in front of my house, the normal kind of neighborly complaints, our diversity is still a point of pride for everyone. And our ethnic businesses are patronized cross-ethnically.
Give us a rundown, August, of some of the main can't-miss things this weekend's festival.
Sunday night is always sort of the Hamtramck homecoming night. It's when everyone comes home to see the Polish Muslims, which, if you're aware, they're a Punchki Day staple. They play Polish festivals across the metro area. And we're really happy to have the Detroit Cobras, legendary Detroit rock god, so to speak. We have the Hamtramck Art Festival as well, sort of a big artist collective right in the middle of the festival featuring local artists. It reflects all the different ethnicities. Last year, they just made a killing.
And food.
Oh, lots of food. We were just talking about the competing shawarmas that are going to be from the new restaurants in town. We have the Polish food. We have the Middle Eastern food. It's going to be
Bosnian
food. Mm-hmm. The smells and sights and sounds are very eclectic.
Yeah, I want to mention a couple of other events. One is the 5K run, the Gwumpki run. That's on Monday at 10 a.m. The other event is the Hamtramck Yacht Club canoe race. And Augie can say some more about that because he's the grand
Well, we do have a Commodore.
We
have a Commodore who manages it.
There's no bodies of water in Hamtramck.
No.
Yes, there are no bodies of water, but they bring the water to Joseph Campo Street. I dress up as the Jack Sparrow pirate. Basically, the streets are lined with people with water balloons, squirt guns, and buckets of water. And contestants have these, basically they're soapbox derby cars without the hill. And they push them down Campo and back.
They're sponsored by the local bars.
Yeah, and getting bombarded with water balloons and squirt guns. And basically, I'm there to keep the children from running out to get their unpopped water balloons and getting run over by canoes. Because these guys are intense. They're running as hard as they can up and down Campo. And it's quite a spectacle.
The whole festival does reflect Hamtramck's incredible history and incredible diversity and strength. Tough times make tough people even tougher, don't they, Mayor?
Yes, they do. But, you know, we're still here. We're hanging in there. And in some ways, I think stronger and more determined than ever.
The Hamtramck Labor Day Festival is September 5th, 6th, and 7th. So a good way to spend some of your Labor Day weekend. And you can get details on the festival by going to hamtownfest.com. Mayor Karen Majewski and City Clerk August Gitschleg, it was really fun talking with you. And I hope the weather is good for the Hamtramck Labor Day Festival.
Why, thank you for that blessing.
Thank you. We'll see you there.
The recent demolition of Detroit's Park Avenue Hotel to make way for the new Red Wings Arena put the historic preservation community in the spotlight as they fought to save the old hotel. That battle got writer Amy Elliott Bragg thinking about the woman who's hailed as the founder of Detroit's historic preservation movement. Her name, Beulah Groen Croxford. Amy, you're the president of Preservation Detroit. It is the city's oldest historic preservation organization, so you truly are following in Beulah's footsteps.
Well, it's humbling to think of that, but it's true. Beulah really created a lot of the mechanisms that historic preservation advocates in Detroit still use today, most notably the Historic District Ordinance, which gives the city of Detroit authority to regulate development, construction, demolition, things as simple as what colors you paint your house in locally designated historic districts. So that makes our work possible.
And this all started for her by going to an estate sale.
Yes. So Beulah was an antiques lover. She was a collector of many different kinds of antiques, among them antique inkwells. But she went to an estate sale in 1965 that was at a house on Canfield Street, mm-hmm. at 2nd and Canfield. This was 1965, and she fell in love with the house while she was shopping at the estate sale. And she inquired about the house and actually put in an offer and ended up purchasing it.
Well, just the fact that she goes to an estate sale and comes home with an old Victorian house says that she's not cut from regular cloth.
Right.
I'm thinking of that time, 1965. I remember 1965, and it was all about modern. Mm-hmm. I have seen that film that had Mayor Kavanaugh in it trumpeting all the modernization mm-hmm. that Detroit was going through, because Detroit hoped to get the Olympics, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
So this was not a time that most people in power had any appreciation for Detroit's old buildings.
No, Detroit's old buildings were seen not as assets or as potentially redevelopable properties, but as kind of musty old ornaments of a time that we were moving beyond. So in 1961, Detroit demolishes the great old city hall that was beautifully ornamented in a very sort of late 19th century style. But to the everyday citizen and to many people in the planning department, kind of looked like your grandmother's couch, just kind of too fussy and kind of dark and a little cramped. And they just, you know, they wanted to get it out of the way so they could build a brand new, shining, gleaming, progressive monument to the new city. And the funny thing now, from my perspective as a preservationist, is that a lot of the stuff we built in the mid-60s is now historic in its own right. Yeah. Some of our great architectural treasures in Detroit were built in that era, all of the beautiful Minoru Yamasaki buildings along the riverfront and on the Wayne State University campus. But that development wasn't going hand in hand with redevelopment of our historic properties. Many people felt the best thing that we could do with those old buildings was tear them down, get them out of the way, and start fresh.
And we saw that in neighborhoods, and I'm thinking of the Black Bottom, mm-hmm. which was the historic Black neighborhood. And I'm wondering how much of that attitude do you think was based in racism, as in it was part of Black life, it doesn't mm-hmm. count?
Yeah, I think certainly that was a big part of those decisions. Mm-hmm. I think that there was a lot of classism in that decision-making as well. I think you saw that in Corktown. You know, a swath of Corktown was kind of cleared for this urban renewal planning strategy. And the idea of Corktown, which was not, you know, it was maybe an ethnic neighborhood, an Irish neighborhood, an immigrant neighborhood, maybe not racism in play in that neighborhood, but certainly this idea that those neighborhoods were slums mm-hmm. and people were living in ill health and too close together and in poor conditions, and that, you know, there was a little bit of condescension behind that attitude as well, which was these people are living in poor conditions and the best thing we can do to help them is tear their gross old houses down mm-hmm. and build some nice, clean, spacious, you
modern.
Know, modern, glossy apartment buildings for them. And that will be the best way for us to help them out.
And here comes Beulah Groen Croxford. She was known then as Beulah Groen, and then mm-hmm. Croxford came later in life. And this was not a young woman. And this was a woman who was a force to be reckoned with?
Absolutely.
How so?
Well, she was very tough, and everyone I talked to who knew her in her life said she was a tiger. She was a force to be reckoned with. Phrase after phrase came out about her tenacity. And one of my favorite phrases about Beulah was something a resident of West Canfield remembered her saying, which is, there are two kinds of people in this life, those who get ulcers and those who give ulcers. And you want to be the kind of person who gives ulcers. And certainly that was the kind of person Beulah was. She was tireless.
And her mission, pure and simple, was to preserve historic buildings if they were worth preserving?
Well, her mission didn't start out that way necessarily. Mm. Beulah's mission was to, you know, she fell in love with this house on West Canfield. And if you've seen West Canfield, it's one block in Detroit of stunning late 19th century, kind of 1870s to 1890s mansions. And it was surprising to me when I was doing research for this story, and this just maybe shows that I'm a little on the young side, but I didn't know that West Canfield had ever been anything but beautifully kept 19th century mansions. But it's not frozen in amber, right? Mm-hmm. West Canfield, at the time that Beulah brought her house, was run down. Many of those mansions had been converted into boarding houses or sort of multi-resident units. There was
perhaps
a little bit
of some shady purposes, shall we say?
Sure, yes. There were maybe some bohemian elements on Canfield. There were maybe some drug dens on Canfield. And right on 3rd Street was notorious for show bars and brothels, allegedly, and just a bad element. It was the caste corridor in the 1960s. Mm. So Beulah came to West Canfield, and it wasn't necessarily that she was on a mission to save all historic buildings. Beulah was on a mission to make her block as livable as it could be. And when West Canfield was targeted for development, people wanted to tear down the mansions and build apartment complexes and student housing. Beulah didn't want to see the character of her neighborhood eroded. And she started to think about what she could do to save the houses that were remaining on Canfield, not necessarily because they were historic, but because they contributed to the character of her neighborhood. She felt that those houses could be redeveloped as she was redeveloping her house and made suitable for people who were working at Wayne State who might want to live in a nice house in Detroit instead of moving out to the suburbs. That's what Beulah had done, yeah. Moved from the suburbs to Detroit. And she felt like West Canfield could be an example of the potential inherent in these historic buildings and these old neighborhoods that people considered useless or of having no value. So she tried to do it through zoning. She tried to do it through, better sort of regulation. And when those avenues weren't working, she started having conversations with people who said, the way to do this might be through historic designation. And that was really the entry from her sort of block level interest in neighborhood revitalization to the bigger picture of historic preservation in Detroit.
And she got that designation even ahead of the state of Michigan.
Yes. So after several years of fighting, Detroit did pass a historic designation ordinance. The state then a few years later passed what's called an enabling ordinance, which kind of gives local communities the authority to pass rules that give communities authority to do that work.
And it strikes me in the piece you wrote for Model D, you wrote that Beulah didn't want to be seen as a blue-haired old lady in tennis shoes trying to preserve the past because it's the past. What did Beulah see as the true meaning of this historic district ordinance?
Well, to Beulah, historic preservation was all about people. She called it a people project, which I love. The idea was not, we need to save these old buildings because they're old. The idea for Beulah was, we need to save these buildings because they matter to people. They tell stories that are about who we are as a community. She saw them as opportunities for education, as places where people could learn about Detroit's architectural history, about architecture itself, and about the heritage that we all share as Detroiters. She saw historic preservation as a way to make our city more beautiful and to sort of enable the kind of neighborhood improvement and revitalization that attracts people to cities. And she felt, I think she was in some ways ahead of her time about this. She also saw historic preservation as a catalyst for economic development in that preservation is an opportunity for people to get into the skilled trades. Preserving a house creates jobs for carpenters and electricians and plasterers and, all sorts of people who need work. And she was really, I think, visionary in being able to make that argument. We are still, as a preservation community, trying to convince the public that we are not blue-haired old ladies in tennis shoes. We're not hugging buildings and strapping ourselves to bulldozers. We're really trying to make a case that preservation is about placemaking, and it's about vibrant communities, and it's about talent attraction, and it's about skilled development. And that's a message that we're still trying to get into the world. And Beulah was, she was saying that before it was cool.
And I'm gathering preservationists in other Michigan cities and towns can learn a lot of lessons from the life of Beulah Groen Crockford.
Sure. Yeah. Well, we could all be more tireless. We could all be better fighters. We could all be standing on principle a little more often, and Beulah teaches us that.
Amy Elliott Bregg, the president of Preservation Detroit. You'll find her profile of Beulah Crockford at modeldmedia.com. Great story on a very challenging and interesting dynamic lady. Thanks so much for sharing with us.
Thank you so much.
Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. A list of 100 of the best restaurants for foodies includes two in Michigan. The survey comes from the online reservation system OpenTable. They examined more than 5 million user reviews of 20,000 restaurants nationwide to come up with their top 100. Michigan is represented by Republic in Detroit and Grove in Grand Rapids. Sarah Welch is executive chef of Republic.
We've been working super hard for the recognition, and it's good to see Michigan getting some attention. I'm bummed that there weren't more than two, but I'm happy to be one of the two that was in the top. The whole staff is very, very excited.
Both Grove and Republic pride themselves on locally sourced produce and meat. Not tremendously surprising, New York has the highest number of restaurants on the list at 12, and California came in second. Still to come, Cut Loose, Jobless and Hopeless in an Unfair Economy. In his new book, sociologist Victor Chen compares auto workers in Canada and America. We hear more in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If you've driven in Europe, the UK, Ireland, you know what to do when you're driving along and come to a roundabout. Well, not everyone. Remember that scene in National Lampoon's European Vacation? The one where Clark and family enter a huge roundabout in London and can't get out?
I guess what we do is just drive around this circle here. It should be the second left exit. There's the hotel. Hey, look, kids! There's Big Ben and there's Parliament!
There it is, there it is, there it is!
I know. I can't seem to get over to the left, honey. I'll try next time. Sorry. We'll get out of this jam in a minute. Kids! Big Ben! Parliament! Again.
Michigan drivers are starting to get more familiar with roundabouts. And now a new type has appeared in our state, the urban roundabout, the first two recently opened in Ypsilanti. Mark McCullough is a senior project engineer with the Washtenaw County Road Commission. Mark, let's all get on the same page here. What's the difference between a roundabout and an urban roundabout?
It's smaller in size from a traditional roundabout. In fact, it's about 50 feet less in diameter. Reason being is that we had the ability to right-size the intersection for this type of a roundabout in order to reduce costs. But in addition to having what they have out there with the flat, flush center island that's made of concrete, the approaches still provide the proper deflection that a traditional larger roundabout would provide for the entry speeds coming in. So that's what makes them unique from other roundabouts that we're used to seeing.
So smaller, and the center part you're saying is basically flat?
It is relatively flat, yes. There is some grade to it. Reason being that it's flat is that because it's smaller in diameter, the larger size trucks still need to be able to traverse through the intersections. It provides them an opportunity to drive directly over it to turn left through a right, depending upon the size of their vehicle and which direction they're going. So that's what makes them unique and very successful.
Mark, what does this urban roundabout give you as compared with the traditional stop sign or stoplight?
To the average driver, what I'm hearing, it's just a roundabout to them, which is great. That's kind of the message we want to get across to them. For us, as engineers, because it's smaller in size, it's less land that we need. So therefore, it translates into fewer impacts to property owners, less money that's needed for right-of-way expense to purchase the land to build it, and also fewer materials needed for construction, which makes it faster to build. So all the way around, win-win.
And what do we get in terms of safety?
When designed correctly, the entry speeds are designed so that it slows everyone down to a point where eliminating those high-speed T-bone collisions that we're used to and accustomed to seeing at the signalized intersections. Red light, someone's trying to beat it, they hit the gas, they could be going 55 or higher, they T-bone someone, and that can have deadly consequences. With the roundabout, we're basically eliminating that. And in exchange for that, if there is a collision out there, it is at lower speeds and typically at side swipes with people already circulating within the roundabout. It makes them much safer.
And do you think it changes driver behavior if people aren't worrying about there's a light coming, you're going to be able to move? So is that what you're seeing, that kind of it impacts the general approach that a driver might have?
Yeah, I think for the most part, people are grasping the hang of them. What I found over the going on close to 10 years now of being in the roundabout game, it's pretty much right down the middle, 50-50. They're like the New York Yankees. You either love them or you hate them. The people that love them, they say they're efficient, they're great, they don't have to wait anymore. Whereas the other people, there's a handful of reasons, but I think the two major ones is change. People dislike or fear change. And two, people just don't feel comfortable because they don't have that green light available to tell them to stop or go, because the roundabout forces them to make that decision when they should enter into the roundabout. But for the most part, I'd say they're a success, yes.
Now, I got to wonder, what kind of challenges do roundabouts pose for pedestrians, particularly disabled pedestrians, and even more particularly the blind and visually impaired?
Yes, it is a challenge from that standpoint. Now, for most able-bodied pedestrians, the roundabout is significantly better for them. And the reason being is that when you look at the layout of a roundabout, they have what we call the splitter islands, or the entryway, into the roundabout. And what that center portion does is it offers them a place of refuge so that pedestrian can focus on one direction of traffic at a time, whereas with a two-lane roadway or more, they have to cross multi-lanes all at once. That, from a standpoint, is better for the pedestrian and also the slower speeds.
Hmm.
Now, from the standpoint of a person with disabilities, it is a challenge. And we as engineers have acknowledged that. And at a national level, we're investigating what remedies we can offer, take roundabouts to the next level to improve the safety benefits for all the pedestrians that would encounter that, especially in urban areas.
Have solutions been tried and tested in Europe where they're much further down the road in using roundabouts than we are?
One thought that's out there is to put pedestrian signals at the roundabouts where it's pedestrian activated and it only would turn red when a pedestrian hits a push button. That's been kicked around a little bit. It has been tried. I don't know the success rate of those signalized intersections. I know that's something that the Department of Justice and the Federal Highway Administration is investigating. They've been talking about implementing that for quite some time now, but to date, it's still not a requirement or guidelines have still not been produced for us engineers to put out there for these designs. So it's kind of a wait-and-see approach we're still taking.
Mark, what's the general feeling about the success of roundabouts throughout the state?
I think the general success is people have less waiting from a standpoint when they come up to a light that they're used to with a lot of congestion, and sometimes they have to wait multi-cycles to get through. They can get through the intersection much faster, especially during off-peak hours. So from that, it's a success for people that are pro-environment, and we all should be pro-environment. It does have less idling time at the intersection, so it's fewer emissions into the atmosphere. From those two standpoint, I think it's a pretty big success to implement roundabouts. But I also like to say that roundabouts are never a silver bullet. They should not be everywhere. They have a place for them, and there are times where we should be sticking with either stop signs or traffic signals. It's important that they only be placed at intersections that make sense.
What do we as drivers need to do to get the most out of roundabouts in this state?
As a driver, the most important thing is yield to circulating traffic, especially when there's a multi-lane roundabout, meaning two lanes entering, two lanes circulating. It's important to yield to the people on to the left for both lanes. Never assume that the person is going to make a turn left or circulating through because sometimes they're exiting, especially in the furthest lane. So take your time. Be patient. Sometimes it's advantageous to use your turn signal when you're in there to alert other drivers what you're doing.
Yeah, I can say that I know that there are still some drivers, just based on personal experience, that don't quite have the hang of it. I've had a couple of white-knuckle moments when you think someone's going to do something and they don't. So you still need to give it that extra beat of caution as you would going through a signalized intersection.
Well, that's true. I mean, when you come up to a red light, it's advantageous for all of us when it turns green not to just blindly assume that the person approaching is going to stop. With roundabouts, I think it's really no different. Always be defensive as a driver. Understand that sometimes people aren't going to yield at the yield sign. I know that's one of the biggest complaints that we hear. People don't understand the meaning of yield. I think as more roundabouts come into play, people will get the hang of the yield. With further education, whether it be driver's ed, whether that be through pamphlets, whether that be through television ads, more and more drivers will feel comfortable moving forward with the roundabouts that we put in.
Mark McCullough is a senior project engineer with the Washtenaw County Road Commission. It was Washtenaw County which recently unveiled and opened the first two in Michigan compact urban roundabouts. They were in Ypsilanti. Thanks for talking with us today, Mark.
Thank you so much for having me.
Since the mid-20th century, those well-paid jobs on the auto assembly lines not only built cars and trucks, they built the American middle class. Today, entry-level jobs in auto plants pay around $16 an hour. And then there are the auto workers who saw their jobs go away, never to return, the long-term unemployed auto worker. Sociologist Victor Tan Chen talked to former auto workers, and he heard about their struggles to stay afloat. The result is his new book, Cut Loose, Jobless and Hopeless in an Unfair Economy. Victor Tan Chen, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks so much, Cynthia. It's great to be with you.
Victor, you are a former reporter for Newsday. Now you're a sociologist at Virginia Commonwealth University. So you're bringing both sets of skills together to tell what story exactly?
Well, it's about the decline of good jobs. And I tried to humanize, you know, what's going on in these broader economic and cultural trends by telling the stories of individuals caught up in, you know, what's happening right now, especially in recent years. As you noted, jobs in the factories, you know, helped grow the middle class in the years after World War II. You know, you had strong unions, high pay, good benefits, job security, you know, even if you didn't have a college degree. And I think the economy and the culture have moved in the exact opposite direction in recent years. And it's represented by, you know, say, the Uber driver, right? No job security, no benefits, hustling every day to make a living. This is becoming the new normal, and it's not just for blue-collar workers. It's also for white-collar workers who are seeing their jobs outsourced and automated away. In a sense, the auto workers and what they went through in the 70s and 80s, the shut-down factories, that's become a symbol for the American middle class today. We're seeing those good jobs that paid well and provided benefits. We're seeing those disappearing with all these trends in the broader economy.
The subtitle of your book, Victor, Jobless and Hopeless in an Unfair Economy. Boy, that does not pull any punches. Tell us some of the stories of these workers that really, really stood out for you, really, in your view, illustrate that title.
Sure. I talked to one gentleman by the name of John who, you know, had worked hard for decades in construction and then in the auto industry. He was a skilled polisher. You know, he had worked hard and played by the rules. When he was a baby, he was abandoned by his parents and raised by his grandmother. And, you know, that had left a hole in him. But he had filled it to some extent, you know, with his hard work. You know, he told me my job was like my mother and father to me. You know, it was all I had. I could depend on that every day. And suddenly, you know, he was let go. He was cut loose. And, you know, all those years of hard work were not meaningful anymore. And that just speaks to the broader economy, right? There's no more room for mistakes. There's no more loyalty. You know, you have to do it all on your own. You have to get an education, get skills, make the right choices, and become successful that way. It is a different world than before, when we had a more collective sense of success in this country, you know, represented by labor unions, represented by efforts to bring about, you know, full employment and other policies at the government level. We've moved away from that. Now it's go it alone and, you know, hope for the best. And that works out for some people, but for many other people, it is not working out. And I think it will get worse. You know, things are getting more ramped up in terms of automation, technology. You know, I think that the number of good jobs in the future might be dwindling as well.
It strikes me that so many of the workers that are in this situation are old enough to have remembered the American dream, thought they were playing by all the right rules, and then, boom, the rules completely got thrown out. So the ladder got kicked out from beneath them. And what you found that really was striking is there's such a huge problem in the way these workers now think about themselves.
Yes, I think that it generates this attitude that you have to make it on your own. It creates more, you know, self-blame, especially as your unemployment gets longer and longer. You can't blame the company as much anymore. It's all on you. You know, you think back, as many of my workers did, on past decisions they had made. And it became a source of anxiety, a source of depression for many of them, because they felt they were failures. And, you know, in the words of one of my workers, you know, she said, you know, I'm a loser. I made the wrong decisions. That's why I'm stuck in this situation. In her particular situation, she lost her job lost any kind of work, and she eventually divorced her husband, lost her house, had to move in with a, quote, man friend, because that was the way to support herself, even though she didn't love this man. These were kind of desperate situations she was pushed into. But in the background was always this kind of thing in the back of her mind, I should have chosen better. And I think that speaks to the situation of a lot of workers caught in this changing world where the rules have changed, where, it's not just about hard work anymore, Cynthia. It's also about you need to have talent, you need to have skills, you need to prosper in this very individualistic kind of economy. And if you don't, you are a loser.
And a competitive economy.
Yes. It is becoming more competitive, even for white-collar workers. A college degree is no longer a ticket into the middle class, right? You need to have certain skills that are in demand. And the level of evaluation and judgment of your abilities, that's really ramped up. It starts at school with standardized testing, right, in schools, how decisive and high stakes they are. And then, the workforce, you are constantly being evaluated through job performance reviews. And Cynthia, on your show recently, you mentioned how even to get a loan, lenders may be looking at your list of Facebook friends and actually, using that in their decisions about whether to give you a loan. So it's just become much more extreme. Every aspect of your life is being evaluated, especially in the job search. Every mistake you've ever made is captured by Google, right? So we have all this information, and we're using it to sort workers. And some people will do very well, but a lot of people will not. And if there's fewer good jobs out there, which research shows that there is, then that is a big problem for the majority of Americans and the majority of the middle class moving forward.
Victor, your book, Cut Loose, Jobless and Hopeless in an Unfair Economy, compares Canadian and American auto workers. Is it a better situation for people in Canada, or do they cope with a lot of the same competitive mindset and same challenges?
I think so, to some extent. But, it's a mixed, complicated situation, because in some ways Canada is becoming more like the U.S. and to some extent, this is just a global problem, right? Because we are competing with other nations for jobs. We are facing pressures of investors leaving the U.S. So I think this is something that's not just an American problem, Cynthia. It's also something that Canadians and Europeans and other people around the world are dealing with. And so we got to think, too, about, I think it is also a technological issue, right? I mean, you look at the development of artificial intelligence and other technologies that will wipe away many good jobs. I mean, you look even among doctors and lawyers, right? There are systems in place now to automate a lot of the document reviews that review that lawyers make, or outsource radiology scans to India. I mean, these things are affecting everyone, not just in America. And I think that we need to think about policies and politics that will actually secure a strong middle class in this country.
It is a very sobering and thought-provoking read, Cut Loose, Jobless and Hopeless in an Unfair Economy, written by my guest, sociologist Victor Tan Chen. Victor, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Cynthia. It's great to be with you.
And that is today's Stateside for you. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.